Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for Climate Talk on KTAH 101.9. This is the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. You know, there's an old expression that goes something like, an expert is someone who lives more than 500 miles from home. And that does seem like there's a bit of human truth in there. The reality is that we have a lot of experts right in our midst here in Tacoma. Many people in government, industry, education, nonprofits, politically active groups, and they're all working for a livable world. I might add livable for everyone, not just the privileged. And Leslie Davenport, who I will be talking with today on this program, lives right here in Tacoma and is just the sort of force for good that we see all over in our community. Leslie is an author and a psychologist who studies, writes, practices, and teaches about the intersection of climate change and how we can maintain our psychological and spiritual equilibrium in these super challenging times. That's as individuals, but her work also points the way to understanding and communicating with folks who hold different points of view than we as individuals might. The simple truth is, supported by a massive amount of data, is the fact that what we're doing here on Earth is not sustainable. We can't keep on doing what we're doing, yet we do keep on doing it. That leads to a whole stable of anxieties or zoning out for individuals who can see what's happening, and especially for individuals who want to be part of society changing course. So here's my conversation with Leslie, and I'll talk to you on the other side. Well, good morning, Leslie. It's great to have you with us today. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Perhaps you could just start off by giving us a picture of who Leslie Davenport is, how you became interested in climate change, and in particular, eco-anxiety and related. By the way, am I pronouncing that correctly? Is it eco-anxiety or echo-anxiety?
Well, you know, I've heard it both ways. I tend to say eco-anxiety.
Okay, well, I'll defer to you as the as the authority on this. So who is Leslie Davenport, and how did you get interested in climate change and eco-anxiety?
Okay, well, let's see. I'm not sure how far back to go because I've had multiple careers, and in one way or another, they seem to be weaving themselves together to be part of what I'm doing now. But let me start with the most recent, and then if there's questions, we can backtrack a little more. And by the way, just thank you for having me and for providing this really wonderful series on looking at various aspects of climate change. It's so needed.
Yeah, no worries.
So prior to, well, first of all, I've been a licensed psychotherapist for more than 25 years. But a big part of it, and it influences how I focus on my climate psychology work, is 25 of those years were spent in a hospital environment working on creating an integrative medicine program. And what that means is we were taking the best of medical science, but blending it with many other healing modalities, including acupuncture, various kinds of body work, massage, Feldenkrais, nutrition, Ayurvedic, East Indian perspectives to health and practice, psychotherapy, meditation, guided imagery. And this was done in the context of a major medical hospital, California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco, huge hospital with five campuses citywide. And so I was one of the founders of that. And one of the ways we worked was we would weekly sit together in council, the MDs alongside all these other practitioners and more, and appreciate the value of the contributions that would come through each of these healing lenses, different perspectives, different ways of assessing, different ways of treating, until there was a cohesive plan we could offer to the patient. And of course, they had their input as well. So it was a collaborative process. So to kind of fast forward, when I became aware of the magnitude of climate change, which was probably a bit over 10 years ago now, And there wasn't a singular event. It's an area I've just always had an interest in. And my eyes were opened in a way that felt as though they could never be closed again to this being a really important priority. I really shifted my life to look at what are the most effective ways I can contribute to climate change solutions. And I started with, participating in protests and petitions, and was part of a clean energy policy committee when I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area. But then I started to say, you know, we are talking about climate change as being a result of human behavior. Why are there no behavioralists at the table? And then I kind of went back and drew on my experience in the hospital. So it became almost like a boot camp to say, you know, it's not that psychology holds the ultimate answer, but it's a really important lens if we can have interdisciplinary approaches, intersectional examinations of climate change, because it is such a complex systems issue. So we need the engineers, we need the scientists, we need the folks like myself who can bring an understanding of what motivates change, how to deal with the huge feelings that arise around climate change, how to help support conversations when it would be easy to polarize or become contentious. That's sort of the, you know, built into the fabric of what I studied and what I did. So I began to take what I understood from all my years of clinical experience and training and see where it would convert into climate change conversations, practices, supports, how the conversation could be a contribution to other approaches. So is that a pretty good sense of how I got to what I'm doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will just comment from my perspective in terms of being a climate activist for a few years. You made the point that climate change is a result of human activity, and the role of psychology to me is almost becoming prominent because we know what the problem is, we know what causes it, we know solutions, yet we look around and we're really not moving anywhere near the speed we need to address that. And psychology, at least as a layperson, I would say psychology is a lot about, okay, how do people think and feel? And of course, those thoughts and emotions result in their behavior, and it's our behavior we've come full circle to causing the climate change that we're seeing. So let's just talk about those emotions for a second here. What do you see as emotional symptoms that are related to climate change? I guess I would say from all up and down the spectrum, from alarmists, and I consider myself an alarmist, to people who are actually denying there's a problem. What are some of the emotional symptoms that we see?
Boy, this is a big area. So I just finished writing a book for tweens on coping with climate change and weaving in some of the climate science, and it's called All the Feelings Under the Sun.
Yeah, great.
So that's kind of the first answer. What shows up emotionally can look like so many things. And some of it is kind of under the surface. For example, sometimes when caring people who have some understanding of what's happening appear to be apathetic or uncaring, sometimes that is an expression of overwhelm. They want to do something, but every time they face it, they don't feel like they have the tools to deal with the intensity of feelings that arise. They feel like whatever they do is not going to make a difference. You know, they're standing at the grocery store looking at blueberries because they want to have a healthy diet, but they're recognizing these were flown in from South America and wrapped in plastic and maybe sprayed with pesticides, maybe a monoculture. And they're like, what do I do? I'm caught in this ambivalence. It's too much. And they kind of check out because they just don't know what to do with the overwhelm. And so to someone like you or myself, who's very active in climate change, some of the folks that, again, appear to be uncaring or apathetic are actually just kind of frozen in their anxiety and ambivalence. So that's one of the many places that psychological tools can be helpful, is to help process those feelings, normalize them, but open them up in a way that they don't get in the way of still doing what we each can do.
So it seems there may be a cousin to what you're talking about, which would be denial, because even as an activist, I feel pressure from fellow activists and organizations that, no, we have to be positive and happy and present a bright future and so on. And I don't, most of the time, I don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. And and I definitely can relate to the overwhelm you're talking about. I mean, you made a reference earlier, sort of like once I know something, I can't not know it anymore. And so everywhere I look, I see the damage that our activities are doing to the environment and how important that environment is to our long-term survivability. So let's say I'm talking to somebody who is sort of zoned out, as you say. What would be the best way to approach those? I'm not a psychologist, of course, so I would be approaching them more just as a contemporary, I suppose.
Yes. It's funny, you know, in the question around how do I talk to someone about something climate related, the best way to talk to someone is to start with listening. I would encourage them to become comfortable sharing some of what I articulated, which may be their own underlying feelings. Because once that is witnessed, once it is validated, once it is normalized, I'm in this with you, I get it, just like you said you could relate to what I described, it starts to free things up, and then it opens up the possibility of a fruitful conversation. You know, if they look at you in surprise with you feel this too, then they may ask you about it. Well, how do you deal with it? You know, what do you do? And that's when more of a dialogue may be possible. But a lot of people, kind of like you're saying, that false positivity, want to jump over this step because it's uncomfortable. The uncertainty, the not being sure what to do, the heavy feelings, the grief, the fears. There's so much, it's so much a part of this. And what we're looking for is neither extreme. We don't want to just sink into this, because certainly that would not be helpful either. But we also don't want to ignore it. It would be like if you have the image of a big ball blown up with air and you try and hold it underwater with one hand. All this ball wants to do is pop up to the surface. And that's kind of like these feelings. If we spend a lot of energy, keep trying to push it down, our arm gets fatigued. It ultimately doesn't work anyway. So what we want to do is let those feelings come up. And there's a kind of, again, a kind of freedom that happens, a kind of flow that happens. Just like everything in life, feelings are not static. You know, our physical sensations come and go, our thoughts come and go, and our feelings, our emotions, are kind of like weather too. They come and they shift and change. And it may seem paradoxical, but the more we make room for them, kind of give them the mic, so to speak, really acknowledge yeah. them, feel them, the mm-hmm. more they are too likely to dissipate or shift or be able to use all that energy in holding them down and put it toward activism or something productive.
Yeah, that seems like a really good pathway, a way of being more, let's say, psychologically honest with myself. I belong to the groups that I belong to, there's a lot of pressure to be positive. If I talk about being gloomy or feeling some grief or some pessimism, I get the answer back, no, don't do that. We have to stay positive. People don't want to hear a negative message. And so I'm just thinking, if we can sit down and talk, be honest, be open with each other, and get just as gloomy as we feel like we want to, then after that, we're freed up to move on, be more positive. And of course, the bottom line, as always, is that we just keep on going.
And I think that's wonderful. And there is the very beginning of things being called climate cafes that do just that. The whole point is it's an informal, perhaps facilitated gathering that's related to the emotional experiences of climate change for the purpose we're talking about, giving it room so that it frees us up. And you know, I would even frame it, you said, you know, let's get as gloomy as we want, which is one way to say it. But I might even just put it in the context of, let's just be authentic. Let's just make room to yeah. include everything that, in fact, is real and part of this.
Yeah, I like that. I guess I picked gloomy because that's kind of like hitting bottom when I fall into gloom. And if I can talk to somebody else or friends honestly, and I love that point, you know, let's just be real rather than pretending things are different. If I can be honest about feeling gloomy, then it does free me up to have a more positive, well, to keep going, I guess, is the big thing.
Yes, exactly.
I don't give up.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, we're in our culture here. We're not very practiced at standing in ambivalence, is maybe a way to say it. If I go back to my experiences in health psychology, you know, I would get someone that I would meet with who just got a life-threatening diagnosis. They have a chance of coming through this with treatment, but it's kind of a big question mark. Doesn't make sense for them to necessarily put all their focus on their mortality. They're alive. There's lots of things they're doing that may be, you know, the direction things are going, that this could be resolved. But it's a similar kind of challenge of, in a way, putting a foot in both of those worlds or both of those possible forward paths. There's major challenges that need to be addressed head on, and there's lots of unknowns, and there's whole other aspects of life that are important to keep engaged because that is part of the wholeness of life and the wholeness of experience.
Yeah, it does seem like life by its very nature kind of takes us to those ambivalent points. I mean, if something is pretty clear, then that's kind of off our plate and the focus tends to be around ambivalence. I've experienced that significantly myself because part of my, let's call it angst for lack of a better term, has been there is so much to do and my efforts seem so insignificant compared to what there is to be done. But the kind of the ambivalent midpoint is, okay, well, that is true, but at the same time, I can make my contribution and I can still enjoy my life while recognizing that there is so much to do and my ability to change things is limited, but on the other hand, I'm not going to throw in the towel either.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You know, it can call on us in a way to really activate a more creative frame of mind, right? That's one of the things it asks of us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get techie here for a second. As a layperson, I'm just wondering, this seems like a pretty new field in psychology, and I'm just wondering, is there research being done in this area? I'm talking about good academic, peer-reviewed, published research.
It's starting to emerge. Like, I don't think you would have heard the phrase climate psychology or the term 5 or 6 years ago. There's other related things. There's a lot of research that coming out of eco-psychology, which has been around much longer, which are things like the health benefits and physical and mental health benefits of spending time outside and in nature. There's quite a bit on that. But I feel like it's, in a way, it's just coming into focus. One of my many areas that I'm trying to do this work is in training others in the mental health profession to become what is now being called a climate aware therapist. So because psychotherapists or other mental health professionals, you know, are just a slice of the general population, and there's varying degrees of understanding and awareness with climate change. So if someone comes in with eco-anxiety, which I consider to be a healthy response, if your eyes are open and your heart is open to what's happening, it's a natural reaction. But if you're meeting with a therapist who's not very educated or aware of that, it certainly hasn't been part of our training, then, you know, you kind of get pathologized. You know, relax, or yeah, you're exaggerating or whatever it is. And so I feel a great need to bring up climate awareness into the therapy rooms. And I'm starting to do it first by offering continuing education courses to mental health professionals, and with the hopes that it will eventually be a required piece of the training.
That does seem like a fruitful path to follow for me. A person comes in to get some help with some kind of problem. Lots of times what looks like what the problem is isn't really the problem. So for instance, let's say somebody comes in, they're having difficulty in their relationship, and it could be just simply that they're feeling some anxiety about the future of the environment, and that's showing up in their relationship. Perhaps their partner doesn't fully support them or something like that. And looking downstream, I think that for us as a whole, that's going to become more and more of an issue as things deteriorate.
Yes. In fact, one of the things I've done is when a person comes into the counseling for the first time, they fill out a form that just provides background about stressors and family life and what they're there for. And I've added a question that everyone is asked to fill out that says, when you hear about what's happening in the world, in particular climate change, how does it impact you? Because some people may not realize until, first of all, they don't expect that to necessarily be something that's included in the counseling room. But there's so many contributing stressors, even if they don't come in with that as their primary reason for seeking out therapy, they may recognize that it's part of what keeps them awake at night, puts them on edge. One of many stressors that does need to be factored in.
Okay, I'm wondering if we can extrapolate from personal experience a little bit here. So looking at my own experience, I've done a significant amount of therapy over the years, and I've found a lot of value in that. I look back at my own experience, and I can see that I had to be dealing with a significant amount of pain in my personal life to get me to do that kind of work. And I'm, of course, grateful for that process. Looking at ourselves as a species, one of the things I wonder is if we are going to have to experience a certain degree of pain before we take action. It's kind of possible to deal with a certain amount of comfort, and then there's some kind of threshold that's crossed, and a conclusion is, well, I got to do something about this. Or in this case, as a species, we decide we really do need to take specific action. Do you think there's anything to that?
Yes, I do. Let me say a little more about this. And again, I'm going to refer back to my health psychology boot camp. Here's a really good example. I met with a woman who, very healthy, good diet, nevertheless got a life-threatening diagnosis. And she said to me, I used to be the kind of person who would get very upset if I chipped my nail polish. She said, now I am reorganizing my priorities. Things are personal. Things are right here, right now. I realize my values were very skewed, and this experience is a catalyst for really transforming my life. And because, you know, again, health psychology, you know, we might say to someone, okay, here's all the reasons you should stop smoking, have a better diet, exercise and meditate. And they'll go, yeah. Plenty of science, plenty of data, but get a personal experience, have a heart issue arise, you know, have some other kind of diagnosis, somehow it becomes a big priority front and center, and that motivation rises in response much of the time. So to that degree, you know, I do think it's going to be a contributing factor. And of course, more and more people are being affected by floods, by fires, by severe weather events. Even little things, starting to see the price of certain foods going up because the way that climate change is already affecting some areas of water and agriculture. And so, yeah, I think when it shifts from being abstract data out there somewhere, other people, some other time, to this is about me and my life and the things and people I care about, It does shift.
Well, I do see a bit of irony in myself, sort of anticipating the time when, once again, as a species, we do start recognizing through our own personal experiences the problems associated with climate change. But one of the things I've noted is that it's not unusual for people who have been affected by a natural calamity that is tied to climate change, flood. I'm thinking about those major floods in the Midwest a year or so ago, or the increasing rainfall that comes out of hurricanes. People who are affected by those things seem to kind of cling to their view that climate change is not real. At least certain individuals do. In fact, in some areas, a lot of individuals cling to that idea. What could we say about that?
Yes. Well, there's a psychological dynamic called motivated reasoning, which is that if someone has a highly prized personal value, and that bumps up against facts that are different, they stay with their value. Now, I was going to say that's. It's a process, though. That's like the initial few responses. There is some evidence, some research that says with accumulating data, it can eventually shift. So it may have to be more than the first fire, more than the first flood, more than, you know, reading a headline before things take hold. But it's, you know, it's challenging. There is There are people who are very entrenched. Sometimes I call it Teflon mind. You know, it doesn't matter what you put at it; it just slides right off. But let me mention one other thing, and then we'll come back to this. It's related. So, when I was working in the hospital, I started to see that there were sort of a third of the hospital population, meaning patients, staff, physicians, administration. One third was like, oh, we love this integrative medicine. Its time has come. We're so glad you're doing this. The bottom third was like, they shouldn't have let you through the door, you quack. And, and the middle third was like, huh, I haven't heard of this. I don't know what this is. I'm curious about it. Do you have more information? I'm willing to give it a try. And that middle third is the really fruitful ground for engagement. And I think there's, a relevant, we can use this model in the climate change world. You know, I was speaking earlier, some people have some awareness, but they just don't know what to do. Maybe, that would be the kind of folks who might be interested in more information or an invitation to be involved. But I tend to just leave the top third alone, the you're a quack ones, and the ones who are already involved and engaged, great, let's, align ourselves. But it's that middle third where I really feel like a lot of this work can happen and bringing people on board.
Yeah, that seems like a really good guidance to pay attention to what the audience is. There's a lot of good data that shows that only about 10% of our population are hardcore deniers. And of course, they're very outspoken, so they do punch above their weight, so to speak, but probably not worth our time working with. When I was in my corporate years, one of my mentors said to me one day, work with the living. And by that, he meant just what we're talking about here, I think, and that is that it's not a good use of resources to try and change the minds of people who are not going to have their minds changed. So we're getting close to the end here. And one of the things that, among many things that I have yet to bring up to discuss with you, and reading some of your background material, I see the term, you use the term psycho-spiritual. Could you say a bit about what you mean by that term?
Okay. Well, yeah, spiritual certainly is one of those words that can mean many different things to many different people. But I tend to think of it as the things we find meaningful, how we find meaning in the world. And that can, of course, have many different models, many different belief systems. So I've always felt as though that needs to be a part of a psychological perspective. It's often separated out to being very practical. You know, how can we make you 10% happier or, sleep better at night? But we're really, psyche really means soul, and so I tend to take an approach that values as comprehensive as we can what it means to be human. And I elicit those questions out of people. It's not that I have an answer for them, but, I'll be, talk to me about what gives your life heart and meaning. Not only, when do you feel happier in a more surface way, but what really matters to you? And to incorporate that into one's life does lead to the more traditional measures of better outcomes, right? Better quality of well-being, et cetera. But I really think it's important to have the dimensionality of that kind of questioning a part of things. And so that can certainly be a part of climate change. It's not just mechanistic. We've got this broken thing and we're going to fix this broken thing. But where do we stand in as a human beings in relationship to the full spectrum of life, to the plants, to the animals, to the ecosystems, you know, to not objectify it, for example, but to really recognize our interconnected place in this web of life. It's not just a philosophy. It's quite literal if we, you know, follow the biology of it.
Yes, meaning seems like such an important thing. Everybody's got some. We don't think about it often, but it's such a powerful force in our lives. So one of the things I'm taking away is that if I'm talking to another person about climate, listening to another person about climate, perhaps it's so important that I can parse out the meaning in their lives to what it is that they're talking about, what it is they're seeing, and how they're concluding what they are concluding.
Yes, very much so. And again, that idea of listening, inviting, like, can you share your world with me, how you view the world? It's a wonderful way to build connection. It's a very respectful way.
I'm somewhat of a student of Stephen Covey. One of the principles he puts forward is seek first to understand. And I've found that to be a very effective thing in my own life, especially perhaps in a conversation that's got the possibility of confrontation. I've seen numerous times that once the other person, quote unquote, understands that I understand the point that they are making or their perspective, that it reframes the whole conversation. And we do have a chance at that point to have some kind of mutually valuable conversation. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Leslie, you are an author of several books. And by the way, I have a great deal of respect for anybody who writes a book just from the mere perspective of the time, energy, effort that's put into creating that, much more than the readers can appreciate often, I think. One of your books is titled Emotional Resiliency in an Era of Climate Change. And I'm just wondering, I haven't read the book yet. I do plan on reading the book, but I'm just wondering, is that book directed towards the layperson? Is it accessible to the layperson, or is it more directed towards a professional?
Yeah, thank you. Definitely, it's readable by the layperson. I've marketed it, or the publishing house oriented it toward the mental health field, as you know, related to what I was describing earlier. But it's very readable, very approachable. It has a lot of practices and experiential things that can be used by individuals, used by groups. I mean, that was part of the point of the book, is a therapist might take one of these exercises and provide it to a client. But people can also just access it themselves through the book.
Well, I'll definitely look forward to reading your book. And there are so many aspects of your field of expertise here, Leslie, that I do feel like we're just kind of getting started. And I'm looking forward to talking with you again. And as we finish up here, I would just like to ask, are there other topics that we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up before we finish?
I will quickly introduce one more idea that I feel like is a really important thing for folks to be aware of. And it comes out of trauma work, psychology. It's called the zone of resilience or the window of tolerance. It's kind of used interchangeably. And the concept is that we sort of, on our state of being and our physiology, we sort of have a ceiling and a floor, in the sense that we can move in this zone where we meet whatever the day's challenges are pretty well. We can have difficult conversations. We can get things done. But if we're too stressed, or it's too big of a situation, or we haven't been eating or sleeping well, our window of tolerance shrinks. And then we tend to either lash out and be reactive, or we tend to check out and stop listening. And what's important when it comes to climate change work, besides its application to daily life, is we can all learn to stretch our window of tolerance. There's a lot of practices, everything, honestly, from mindfulness type things to anything that's kind of self-soothing, self-regulating. And why it's so important is that we are all going to be asked to have to bear witness to bigger challenges in ourselves and the people we care about in the world around us with climate change. And we are not psychologically prepared to do that. But there are things we can do now, in addition to looking and working toward climate change solutions, that prepare us psychologically.
Well, thanks for that added topic, Leslie. It does seem like a truly significant area, and one that I really haven't given a lot of thought to, and perhaps we as a society need to be paying some real attention to this, especially folks who are, let's say, in a more of a leadership role in thinking about how to prepare ourselves for the things that more or less appear certain to be coming along, not good things from the climate and a result of climate change, which takes me back to my point that I believe that this subject you just brought up could probably be the subject of an entire interview. So I'll look forward to exploring that idea with you as time passes. Well, as we finish up, Leslie, I am very appreciative of you taking the time to talk with us and give us your perspectives. Lots to chew on for sure. And I'm pleased to have been a small part of getting your important ideas put forward. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Yes, I'm really glad to join you in this conversation.
Well, it was certainly great talking to Leslie and getting her views. If you'd like to learn more about what she's up to, you can just simply do a web search on Leslie Davenport in Tacoma, and it'll take you to her website. And I will also be leaving a link to her website in our program notes for today's show. You can find those notes at ccltacoma.org. Just look for the Climate Talk link and click on that, and it'll take you to the program notes. I would love to hear from you. If you got a comment, you can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. And oh, by the way, Leslie and I are in talks about collaborating on a climate education course, continuing education at TCC this spring quarter, so you can stay tuned on that. That's it for today. Reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care.